Have you ever read a self-help book that absolutely transformed your life?
Or have you ever read one that made you feel worse after reading it and you didn't know why?
I'm Misty Stinnett.
I'm Lisa Linke.
And we are the hosts of Go Help Yourself, a comedy self-help podcast to make life suck less.
On our show, we review the best and the worst self-help books of all time.
We read and review the buzziest self-help books so you can find out if a book is a total gem or a complete waste of time.
There are already over 100 book reviews ready for you to listen to. And we don't just talk about books.
That's right. We discuss every aspect of the self-help world, covering topics like relationships, boundary setting, finances, productivity, and so much more.
No matter what we're discussing, we come at it with a critical eye, a lot of heart, and a healthy dose of humor.
So help us out and tune in to Go Help Yourself wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women.
Some of these queens are heroic.
And some of these bitches are horrific. But we think the most interesting thing of all is that they're all notorious. Yay!
Okay.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. We have a wonderful treat for you guys, as I'm sure you can tell by the title. But we have today our very own author. Author who has written a wonderful book about deliciously notorious woman.
Mm-hmm.
Annie Reed is our guest today. And Annie is a writer, historian, and attorney, non-practicing at the moment. But she did earn her law degree from the University of Notre Dame. So she's very, very smart. And her history degree from the University of Illinois. Her debut book, the book that we're going to be talking mostly about today, is The Imposter Heiress, Casey Chadwick, the greatest grifter of the Gilded Age. It came out this year and is published by Diversion. Annie lives with her family near St. Louis, Missouri. In her spare time, she runs marathons and cheers on the St. Louis Cardinals. She is represented by Amy Bishop Wysick of the Trellis Literary Management. Annie, thank you. Welcome to the Notorious Women Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yes.
Totally.
Yes. We are very excited about your book. Is it Casey or Cassie? Is it Cassie,
Cassie
or Casey?
It's Cassie.
Yeah. Cassie Chadwick, the greatest grifter of the Gilded Age. Come on.
I'm so excited for her. Can I just side note real quick? You said Casey, but you did pronounce Notre Dame, Notre Dame. I just love that about you,
okay.
Lavetta.
Okay. I'm American, so I don't. I try. And when I'm trying to sound fancy,
yeah, heard it.
I do a terrible French accent.
I love it.
But well, depending on where you are in the United States. No, Annie, what were you about to say? I'm sorry to cut you off.
I wondered if you were like French speaking or something. It sounded great to me.
No.
So sounded very French.
No, she can't speak French if you paid her. No, but she can speak Japanese.
All right, pipe down. Pipe down, Miriam.
I do love you, but...
Okay. I mean, my Southern accent does butcher a lot of English things and French stuff, but we have to behave because we have Annie here.
Sorry,
Annie,
my bad. Okay.
Annie, please tell us about yourself. First of all, where did you get your start? You say that your bio says that you are a non-practicing lawyer at the moment. I know a lot of lawyers would be like, I'm a recovering attorney. So
all of my friends who are lawyers at this point are now non-practicing. Just want to share that.
Oh, okay. Not surprising.
Yes.
I can't ever really say that I was a practicing full-fledged attorney. I passed the bar exam and I started looking for jobs. When we were living in Ohio, my husband and I, and it just, we kept moving around. So it was never someplace long enough to like dig into the trenches and the job stuff. And then I started my family and started writing. So that's my origin story, I guess.
So law school was a breeze compared to motherhood and wifehood. So
pretty much.
I've never been to law school, but I'm going to say yes.
Yes. Now, what led you to get into... I'm sorry. Go ahead, darling.
I was just going to add that law school, motherhood, no sleep either way. So it, like, that's one similarity is that there's just no sleep at all ever.
I never thought about that, but you're so right. Now, as far as your writing fiction, what led you to this? Because obviously your background is in law and history. Mm-hmm. So obviously your subject of your first of your debut novel is a great like first outing. Like, but what led you to decide to want to write this tale about Cassie?
Well, it's actually like it's nonfiction. So this all happened in history. It's all very historical. And I was listening to a history podcast years ago, and it had a Cassie Chadwick episode. And I was living in Ohio, and I had just never even heard of her. And I love history. I love crime history. And so yeah. I was just really intrigued. And I looked for a book to read about her. But like, this was so long ago. Like at that point, the only book that was out had been written in 1975, and it was more fiction than history and just really outdated. And so I thought, I have the skills to, if there's enough information out there, I can write this book. And there was a lot of information. So I wrote the book.
Yeah. I mean, it's nonfiction, but it reads very much like a fictional narrative. Like your approach is really, really engaging. It really, really brings the reader in. So they feel, you almost feel like it is a fiction. You know, it's like a salacious, like Shonda Rhimes-esque kind of, you know, and I know people will do a lot of the comparison of Anna Delvey, you know what I mean? But just the way you write it, it's just that your approach is so lovely. So I just want, we encourage readers to go and pick up The Imposter Heiress, Cassie Chadwick, The Greatest Grifter of the Gilded Age by Annie Reid. And I think that they will be very, very surprised, even though it's because when you hear nonfiction, you think, oh, it won't be interesting. It won't move at a great pace. No. But yours does.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Can you kind of give us like the rundown of what she did? Like, I know, like, read the book, you guys, because it gets way more interesting. Yeah. But I just want to, like, you know, we're a Notorious Women podcast. We love to go through the lives of the women that we talk about. I would love for you to go through a little bit of, like, what this woman managed to do in this time.
Yeah. What made her notorious?
Yeah.
First of all, thank you, Lavetta, for saying all that stuff about my book. I did write it hoping that it read like a novel, and I'm glad that that worked.
Yeah. Absolutely. So
Cassie Chadwick was a Gilded Age grifter. Her biggest con, she kind of lived a life of going from con to con, right? She was this con artist who was always pulling some kind of scheme from when she was 21 up until she died. Her biggest one, and the one that made her like infamous, was that she spent years in Cleveland convincing people that she was Andrew Carnegie's illegitimate daughter. And she borrowed a ton of money. Yes. Yeah. she
That's
started
brilliant.
Yes. It's wild. It would be like if now someone started running around saying they were like Bill Gates's daughter or something like that. But don't tell
I
me when it's a
Bill
big secret.
Gates's
like
daughter. You guys, yes. This is why you're here. I wanted you both to know that I am Bill Gates's illegitimate daughter and he owes me a lot of money. Okay.
It's just so crazy. And, you know, I want to read a little bit from the epilogue to give people, because I know people are wondering, like, how the hell did she pull this off? Right. And I think obviously it was a different time. You couldn't really research people the way you can. And even now people are still scammed and pretending to be other people. But I just want to read a little bit from the prologue, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
So the prologue from The Imposter Heiress, Cassie Chadwick, The Greatest Grifter of the Gilded Age, begins, quote, "Finally, the carriage arrived. Mrs. Chadwick gave the address 2 East 91st Street and 5th Avenue. As the wheels rolled on, the attorney tried to recall the wording of the agreement he had drawn up for his client. Essentially, it was a gift. $7 million was to be gifted to her by a second party. And that party? None other than Andrew Carnegie. The attorney, as usual, was satisfied with his work, but questions burned in his mind. How did Mrs. Chadwick know the richest man in the world? And why was the Steel King gifting her $7 million? The attorney had come to no conclusion by the time the carriage pulled up at 2 East 91st Street. Carnegie's mansion loomed ahead, 3.5 stories of trim red brick and neat white stone arranged in near perfect symmetry. The attorney found his eyes snatching in every direction, greedy to take it in. They caught on a magnificent copper and glass canopy hanging over the front doors, its crystalline panes snared sunlight and glittering winks as the carriage rolled to a stop. The attorney started to stand, his pulse quickening. This was an opportunity, and one that he did not intend to squander. Thus far, he had built up a fine career. All Cleveland esteemed him as an accomplished lawyer. But transacting business with Andrew Carnegie could open doors he had never dreamed of before. End quote. I mean, that goes to show you the best con, right, is to really have other people buy into the illusion and the dream that they too could prosper from it.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
It's really telling. Yeah. Go on.
She pulled on these like strings of greed and ambition that all these men thought, oh, I could be kind of working with Carnegie. I could make Carnegie know who I am. And greed and ambition. People wanted to be connected to Carnegie.
And it sounds like, you know, when you're reading the book, you realize that, you know, she, like to your point, she had tried other similar schemes, but this was like the biggest one of all, obviously, because of the time period and Andrew Carnegie. But if you don't mind, can you help us a little bit? You know, when people read the book, they'll get more into this. But if you want to give us just a little teaser about where did Cassie Chadwick come from? Like, who was she really? Yeah. And like, what do you think drove her to have the cojones to try these sort of scams?
She was born Elizabeth Bigley in this really small Canadian town called Eastwood. And it was kind of this rural town. There was a sawmill. There was this like little like train depot, basically. And that was kind of it. Her family, they farmed. There are a bunch of kids, but there wasn't a whole like they didn't make the news in any way. They weren't remarkable or notorious in any way. This was almost ingrained in her from what I could gather.
Yeah, that she just has. But, you know, I also think that, because I know you mentioned in the book that she had tried early on in youth to be like, well, I want these things. I want, you know, fine things in life and what I want to see. I want the things that I see other people have. And one way to do that is to become a man, a boy. So
yeah.
She does a little thing of cutting her hair and, you know, at first. But I also think that perhaps the fact that she was a woman, and this is often the case with a lot of our notorious women, that she's able to fool people because they don't think women are smart enough bright enough to come up with this idea. Do you think that that's true with Elizabeth or?
Absolutely. I mean, she used throughout her life, and especially as Cassie Chadwick, but she just used sexism like in the Gilded Age as this weapon in her arsenal. Like these men that she was getting to give her all these loans, they saw a rich woman and she would play the part of like this frivolous, airheaded heiress who just couldn't keep track of where her money went. And she just couldn't possibly manage it all. And the men bought into it. She would also promise them these huge bonuses when they would loan her money. And I mean, these bonuses were just really, really unreasonable. And they thought, oh, well, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She'll pay me like $20,000 to use $60,000 for 6 months. And, you know, she's never going to know that this is just obscenely too much money. So she definitely used sexism to get what she wanted. Just that people's expectations of her were too low.
I love that she just basically played the airhead, which a lot of rich people or the offsprings of people who actually made the money. What's the saying? I think it came from the Gilded Age. It takes one generation to build it. Yeah. The second generation spends it. And then what's, am I getting that wrong or something?
I've heard it before, but I'm the same as you. It's something with somebody built it. Somebody does something to it and then somebody loses it. And I don't know what the middle section of that is. But
it doesn't end well. I remember that.
I think it's like someone, they build it, they spend it, and then they lose it. In like three generations or something.
Right.
Which is so crazy.
Now, I have a question. Did Cassie herself, did she like, while she was scheming Andrew Carnegie, and P.S., I'm not just like FYI, like not a fan of like breaking the law. Don't come at any one of us. But if you're going to steal from Andrew Carnegie, I'm actually kind of okay with that. Can get behind that. Like maybe he won't do something awful with that specific 7 million that he would have. So, but I'm wondering, like, what was her day-to-day life while she was getting this? Like, do you know, like, did she get married? Was she like a lady of the house? Was she like, you know, having callers unto her? You know,
So when she was pulling the Carnegie con, which like most of this was actually using Carnegie's name and reputation to get bankers and like lawyers and just a prominent men. She would find all these prominent Clevelanders, New Yorkers, Pittsburgh men and Boston men to like give her these huge loans. And so a lot of it was these meetings with these men, right? Like she would go and meet with them. She would meet with like, she had so many attorneys because she didn't want, she tried to keep her loans separate, right? So that no one person knew that the money that she paid them back with was from another loan and not from Carnegie himself. So she would meet with lawyers, she'd meet with businessmen. And then she had this day to day, like society life. Like she would go to she would throw luncheons. She would go to parties and society weddings. She traveled to Europe every summer. Just the things she did shopping. She did a lot of shopping. things that society women were expected to do. That was the other part of her daily life.
It sounds so much like the Annie Delvey scam, actually. I wonder if Anna
researched,
came up with this idea. Like maybe she heard the same podcast or like a snippet of a podcast and was like, let me, even though I know it predated mostly by her scams, were kind of along that line.
It's literally the same thing.
That she just pretended
back there and then she looks like she's like posh and fancy. When really she just like stole money. Yeah.
Cause it's like it's the promise of getting an inheritance, right? Cause that's what Anna Delvey's thing was. And so it sounds like with Cassie, she was saying, oh, I'm going to get my inheritance. Like I already have money, but I'm going to get my inheritance from Andrew $7 million, which $7 million in what we're looking at 18.
That's like $500 gazillion.
1902, between like 1898-1904, sometime in that period when she did when she went to his house.
So that is the equivalent of, I have to do the math. I'm very curious. I'm always like, oh, what is that the equivalent of?
I know. I don't do math, so that's fine.
It's saying that. It's
unless
about
my kids need help in their math.
$200 million.
Damn.
Yes.
So that's why they were salivating at the mouth. The idea that they could be in business with somebody who's worth $200 million.
Yes.
And so because I love that it's an adjacent scam, right? So she's not scamming Andrew Carnegie. She's using his name to scam other people, which I think is something only I think a woman really would come up with because, you know, to your point, Annie, you know, basically we know about Charles Ponzi, right? We know about the Ponzi scheme, but Cassie Chadwick's Carnegie scheme, like dwarfed the Ponzi scheme from the famous, like,
So
do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm not sure what Ponzi's numbers were. I think they were higher. He was a couple decades later, but when he got busted, when he got busted, this reporter like wrote this whole little thing about, oh, Ponzi's a great criminal or whatever, but he's a piker compared to Cassie. And he talked about how Ponzi was fooling all these like friends, working class people. They didn't know finance. He was getting all these investments from people who just kind of took his word for it, and they had no reason not to. To where Cassie was going to bankers, attorneys, businessmen, like all these people whose job was to know about stuff like finances and legal stuff. She went to people who knew Carnegie and convinced them of all this stuff and got them to give her all this money. And that was his point, was that like she was fooling people who should have known much, much better. And she just.
Yeah.
Wow. That is such a great point. And I think that's, again, something only probably that because the low expectations of a woman, and especially if she's putting on the flighty act, would work. Because I think a man, they would be like, cut to the chase, show us the proof. You know what I mean? Whereas like, it'd be a lot easier.
They're like, of course she's stupid and doesn't realize we shouldn't get 20,000 off of this thing, but we're gonna because she's stupid. Good job.
Yeah. Right. And it keeps them from asking real questions, right? Like probing deeper, because they're like, oh, the feminine brain can't really handle it. That's why she doesn't know, right?
Because
she's a woman, so she doesn't know. So.
She probably can't even answer the questions that we have, kind of thing. Yeah.
That is just so crazy. I mean, I just love the idea that... Now, what would you say is her motivation beyond money? Because I think, you know, in the book, you talk about how, like, you know, her life of scamming starts very early. But what was the thing that you think kept her going? Was it the... Because I feel like scammers sometimes love the idea of fooling people just as much as they love the money.
Oh, yeah. I think she enjoyed the game. I think she really enjoyed just... fooling people over and over again. She enjoyed getting people to do what she wanted them to do. She liked the game. She was pretty ambitious. I mean, I think she kept seeing a couple rungs up in society, right? Like she moved onto this mansion on Millionaire's Row, except it's, which is this, this street in Cleveland where all the millionaires lived, right? It's where all the Cleveland, like the Rockefellers lived on Millionaire's Row, except they live on the other end. And so she's living in a mansion and she's a doctor's wife and she has this money. But then she's starting to see all these other richer people down the street. And I think she just has this ambition and this, like, if she sees it, she wants to try to be a part of it and she wants to try to climb up there. And I think to me, that seemed to be her motivation after a while was just climbing and climbing and climbing.
Yeah, it's like what's never enough. And I often wonder with scammers, do they, like, what is the ultimate scammer's dream? That they just continue to scam people until they die? And then only once they have passed do people realize that they have been duped? Or do they know that inevitably the jig might be up and they're going to get caught and in prison? Or do they just think in the moment? Or are they just not thinking that far ahead?
I think a lot of them think in the moment. I read this book. I can't even remember where it was from, but some book about confidence artists who are these, like, these people who do it over and over again. Right. And saying that it's almost a compulsion, like gambling. It's just like, it almost becomes an addiction and you just don't think you can lose. You just want to keep doing it. And you've created all this confidence. You almost fool yourself into thinking you're never going to go down. You're never going to lose.
Oh, that's so interesting. It's kind of like how, you know, you start the book and how in her daydream, you know, that this is like every little kid. When you watch Annie, you're like, like I belong to a rich. I'm going to get adopted by a millionaire, you know, and like
that was me.
My family.
I was obsessed with it. Yeah. I can quote the entire movie, but I won't.
Oh my gosh.
And you're welcome.
Oh my God. And I also think that like her or con artist, we keep saying scammer, that's more modern term, but con artists, I think they were particularly effective in the Gilded Age, right? Because the Gilded Age is this time of enormous wealth in the United States. But it's the name hints at it, gilded, right? It's not real. Yeah. It's like gilded in gold. It's not real underneath. Mm-hmm. It's not solid. And, you know, it came to an end, obviously, when we instituted the income tax, because these these billionaires by today's standards were making all this money and not paying taxes on it, right? And so you have this enormous wealth disparity. But I think it was also a prime time for con artists because there's so much money going around, right? There's so much money around. And I guess I sort of don't blame Elizabeth. She was like, well, I want a little bit of that. But again, to your point, there's this like need to keep going. Because she probably could have just scammed a little bit without having to pull the Carnegie.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. And like the other thing about the Gilded Age that she was playing on was it was all this money and a lot of it was fast money, right? Because there's all this speculation going on. People, like you can invest some money in like a railroad company or an iron or a steel company and like, within a couple months, you can get a really big return or it could go under and, you know, the whole economy could kind of buckle. And it was just like these fast changes, fast money. And she was playing on that, that putting some money in the right place could get a big return quickly.
Yeah, it's so amazing. I just love, one of my favorite, I tend to be with between me and Miriam, I tend to like the bad girls.
She loves the bad girls. Like I've learned so much about women in this world from Lovetta. Like, they do amazing, crazy, terrible things. I enjoy it, though.
Sometimes you need to chop up a body and put it in and hide it in the swamp for the alligators
exactly
to get it.
Exactly what I mean, I'm thinking about right now. Yes.
I mean, sometimes it just calls for this. Like, listen, Dolores Claiborne is one of my favorite movies. But
I read that book a long time ago. I have not seen the movie.
Oh, yeah. The Kathy Bates performance. I mean, anything Kathy Bates is in. She's amazing. So, but these women, because the whole point of our podcast is that women are just as awful and wonderful as men. Like they're human beings. And so because because sometimes, unfortunately, the difference between with the sexism of it, the difference between men and women often is that a woman could be doing a great thing, like a thing to help people and be considered notorious.
Yeah.
Where, and a man could be doing terrible things and be considered like, oh, a titan of industry. You know what I mean? Because, you go back and you look at these titans of industry during the Gilded Age and some of them did some really like just screw people over for no reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. They were such motherfuckers. I'll say that. And we are just like, oh, yes, Carnegie Lane, Carnegie Hall. We're still good with that, you know? And it's like, did you know what he did? A lot of it was bad, you know?
Right.
But I also think that she's very, Cassie's very astute in the sense that the whole like suggestion of impropriety, right? That she's an illegitimate child. Because since the beginning of time with the royals and all this other stuff, the idea of outside children, as we say in the common vernacular today, it could be one of those things like, oh, they just want to buy her off if he gets wind of it, just want to buy her off. So this actually could be a scam that turns out to be true because if he's not sure, if he's had like... extramarital affairs.
And you know he has. I'm just going
to
say it.
I mean, like, almost certainly. Yeah. His biographers seem to think so. So, I don't know about extramarital affairs because he married super late in life.
Yeah.
But that, that he was not.
But taking the, in the company of a lot of ladies, you know, that may or may not. May not have had his children. And also, I love the idea that because if it was a boy, if she were a boy, it'd be different because the idea of like, oh, this is his illegitimate daughter that he won't give her money because back then women should be taken care of, right?
Right.
Also playing into the patriarchy of it all. It's very ingenious.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I
didn't even think about that. Well, what is she going to do with less than 7 million? I mean.
Well, I mean, it also plays into like convincing lawyers and other people that this is going to happen because it's like, well, of course, if he realizes this is his daughter, he's going to take care of her because it's not like she can get a job. Right. You know, it's not like, and he will pay her to go away. I'm thinking about like today, you know, Dr. Dre's daughter. And this was like, I think maybe last year or two, I think maybe about almost 2 years ago, it came out that his Dr. Dre has different, you know, sets of children because he's an older man now. But his first set of children, he has a daughter in her 40s. And somebody found her. I think it was TMZ that she was driving for Uber to make extra money. Mm-mm. And she was estranged from him. And it looks bad that Dr. Dre, who's a billionaire, your daughter and your grandchildren, like she has like three children. She's like, well, I got to like feed my children. The fact that Dr. Dre's daughter is having to drive Uber to feed her children, his grandchildren, like, and it's like, we know you may be estranged from your daughter. And she said that he got mad at her. So sort of basically cut her off, which is why she had to do this. But it's like, you're mad at your child, but you're it's not a good look to have your daughter. Mm-mm. Like, you can't give your daughter $100,000 a year. Like, that's like,
you can't
like a penny. You, that's like less than a penny to you. Like,
notice it.
No. Yeah. So there's that. Boy. So I can imagine during the Gilded Age, that idea also, like, not only it's like you said, you know, it may not be, oh, he was married at the time, but the idea that you're leaving your daughter, your blood out in the cold to fend for herself, of course. So he might pay to have it go away.
I mean, yo, there were no DNA tests. Everyone could be Andrew Carnegie's illegitimate daughter. Come on. I'm Andrew Carnegie's illegitimate daughter. Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, and I think that was part of the reason he was really reluctant to come and testify in any kind of legal proceeding.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, back in when she was in Toledo, she pulled a similar scheme. She didn't say she was someone's daughter, but that this iron magnate from Youngstown was like her brother-in-law and that he had seduced her sister. It was just some like scandalous story that she gave a couple different stories. And he had to come to the trial and say, no, I don't know this woman. I didn't have a child with her sister. I've been happily married for decades, you know. And I think Carnegie did not want to have that moment where he's on stand talking about whether or not he knows this woman who's been claiming she's his daughter.
Yeah, and the idea that he's this very powerful man, I can see it from his point of view. It's like, I don't know this woman. And even if it were true, let's say if it's true, I'm not luring myself to go in public and testify. Like, I'm like, this is beneath me. And I also think that Elizabeth, a.k.a. Cassie, was smart to like play into that. And maybe she had learned from the previously failed attempt. You know, she had innovated and gotten better at it. I think it's interesting, too, that she's pulling this in Cleveland and not New York.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, it's so funny. It's like she picked the perfect titan. Right. Because Carnegie at this time, he was the richest man in the world. He had sold U.S. Steel to J.P. Morgan. I think it was 1902 when that happened, becoming the richest man in the world. And he also was known as one of the most generous. So he's donating all these libraries, all the Carnegie libraries you see around. Yeah. He's like Library Santa Claus. Right. And so everyone knows he's generous and everyone knows he's rich. And so people think, oh, well, Andrew Carnegie would want to take care of his daughter because he just cultivated this image of being generous, and he was a statesman, and he was really trying to work on his image, especially after some of the things from his past had kind of become a disaster for him, public image wise. So he certainly did not want to come and he did not want to be associated with this even a little bit. He was very angry. He issued this public denunciation that he didn't know Cassie Chadwick. He hadn't signed these notes. And people were still thinking, oh, well, he's just doing that for show. So now he'll go behind the scenes and pay off all of her debts. And that made him very, very upset. I mean, just I found it kind of comedic that it took a while for people to really believe that she was not his daughter in reality. It's just mind blowing how deeply she rooted this story.
Yeah, I mean, you repeat a lie enough, it becomes truth for a lot of people, no matter what happens, right? And so, and it's so interesting to your point about she picked the right mark, right? Because this wouldn't have worked on a Vanderbilt.
I was thinking that too. Like Rockefeller would be like, absolutely not. You know, like, even if you are, I'm not giving you my money. Okay, bye. You know.
Yeah. Like yeah.
Yeah, they were.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry. There were other like robber barons back then who had illegitimate children, but everyone kind of knew about it, where Carnegie would kind of be the one to want to keep it a secret. And it just, he had this image that she was working on and playing on when she was using his name.
That's so interesting.
Can I ask how many years did this last? Did the lie like continue with the Andrew Carnegie portion of her scamming?
So it all blew up in 1904, and that's when she could not pay her debts anymore. People start suing her, and things start coming out in the newspapers. When she started telling people she was Carnegie's daughter, it's a bit of a mystery because everyone lied about it. You know, everyone said, oh, I've never heard that story before. I don't know anything about that. At least by, I want to say 1900 or 1902, but I think it was earlier. Okay. I think when she married her husband that she told him. And he denied things that people said, no, you were there, so you obviously knew about this. And so he denied everything. But it was at least 1900 or 1902 that I want to say that she started telling people that we can like document, okay, this was where she was telling people this. It was probably earlier. Again, it's because everyone just wanted to distance themselves and, you know, whatever, that it's hard to date specifically, but it was years. It was years.
Wow. Okay. Did her husband know that this was a grift? Do you know,
I don't think he knew it was a grift. So the simple answer is nobody knows, because he denied he said, I didn't know anything about any loans or finances or Carnegie or anything. When he was well aware that she was in debt and that she had all these debts, he was signing notes for her. He was going with her towards the end to a couple of these meetings with bankers to try to get more money. So he knew that they were in debt. And he was in the room when she told one of his best friends that she was Carnegie's daughter. So he denied everything. In my mind, I think that he did not know she was scamming everyone, but he knew that she was telling people she was Carnegie's daughter. And I would bet he kind of bought into it and that he was fooled as well. But again, he was just he just denied everything, so it's hard to know for sure, but it's really hard. There's no world in which he didn't know that she was telling people all this stuff, that she was Carnegie's daughter, in my mind. And I think he was probably one of the fooled rather than one of the part of the con,
You know, this kind of reminds me of like what happens today with celebrities, right? So I'm thinking in particular, I don't know if you're familiar with Kevin Hart, basically they had some video of him stepping out on his wife. So the people reached out to be like, well, pay us and we'll make this go away. And apparently Kevin is not the right person to try and blackmail, because he came out himself and said, yeah, I stepped out of my wife, I'm sorry, you know, that kind of thing. He got in front of it. And then it turns out one of these extortion attempts was from like somebody within his circle.
A guy
friend who behind the scenes was kind of like turned off by the fact that his image was this like family man, you know, even if he's divorced and he's new, like this family man. And there was rumors that his current wife now was having an affair with him while he was still married to his first wife, which his first wife says. And then actually his second wife, during an anniversary, she actually came out and kind of confirmed it indirectly. It was like, 7 years together. And people were like,
what I said was 5 years of our relationship.
But it's like, but it was just so interesting because Kevin publicly is like, I'm not the one to try and blackmail, but I wonder how many celebrities that this does happen to. So I feel like in the TMZ world of it all, you know, it's like, I have this tape, because think about back to the Jay-Z Beyonce elevator fight, or Solange Knowles and Jay-Z rather. And so if you have this film, like this tape, you go to TMZ will probably give you like $250,000 because they're going to make so much money off of clickbait when they post it. You know, now you have to be careful because it's like if you work for the place, but I guess if you're an employee, you make $20 an hour. You're like, fuck this. I'm going to get $250,000. Yep. But right. the idea, but yeah, let's say you go to Jay-Z first and say, hey, I have this tape. I can get rid of it. I can give it to you and I can get rid of it so TMZ doesn't get a hold of it. TMZ would give me $250,000. Can you give me $500,000 or a million? And like, I mean, I wonder how many times that has actually happened in Hollywood and we don't know about it because the tape disappeared. Yeah. You know, and so essentially that's what she was trying to do, I feel like, to Carnegie, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were people thinking that she was, there was this theory that she was waiting for him to die and then, because he was older at this point, present herself, you know, with his heirs and say, try to extort money out of them. Like, I won't tell anybody that I've been living as his illegitimate daughter for years if you just give me a million, something like that. And I, I mean, that could easily have been her long-term plan. I don't really know, but yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Even though, but going too public kind of like defeats that purpose, but maybe initially that's what she was thinking, but then realized that people would give her money in the interim and then was like, oh, I can get money right now versus waiting till he died.
Right. Right.
You know, it's so ingenious. I think, and honestly, I think it's the kind of scam that only a woman could pull. Like, right? I don't think a man would, I think, like you said, a man would realize, like Charles Ponzi, like he duped regular people who wanted to invest and, you know, some well-off people were like, oh, I want to get in on this investment fund because it seems to be doing so well. But the fact that she would go in, into the den, the mouth of the enemy of like lawyers and, you know, bankers, people who should know better and pull this, it's so brazenly. I just feel like only a woman could have pulled this off. Do you agree? Or what do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, like, especially being able to play on this whole, just fool people so much easier. With a man, they might have thought like, well, something's up because a man would know where his next $170,000 is coming from or where his, what his finances were doing. But she could just fit into this role that I don't think a man could have fit into. And I mean, you're totally right. I never thought about this, but if she had been a man, people might have said like, well, why can't you go be a lawyer or go be a doctor or, you know, like go make money in your own way. And like as a woman, just there were very few options for just even making a living, not to mention making a fortune. It just wasn't something you could do.
I just love that. Basically, she achieved this for weaponized flightiness. She weaponized like flightiness and incompetence.
You know, that's good.
Wow. Yeah. This is so exciting. What is your next project? Have you thought about your next project beyond this? Because this one's just amazing. People.
It's so good. I think everyone listening should go to their local movie producer and get this book into a movie. Okay.
Like, actually, you know, to that point for the imposter heiress, Cassie Chadwick, The Greatest Grifter of the Gilded Age, your book, have you thought about adaptations? And if so, like, who would be your like dream cast for this?
Oh boy. I think there are a lot of people that could do it. I think my thought was Amy Adams, just because I don't know, I could just see her doing the kind of aloof, flighty, but also very sharp and smart under the surface, the whole duality of it. I think she would do a good job.
Oh, I love Amy Adams. Have you thought about
Amy, if you're listening, this is a good idea. Yeah.
Actually, I think Amy would be like, that's actually a really good idea. Yep. Let me get that into my production company. Do you think of maybe a TV series or, I mean, we've had the Anna Delvey series on Netflix with Shonda Rhimes, but I wonder a movie, like you said, because it's Amy Adams. I mean, she's done television, but she's known as a movie star.
Right.
Mostly.
I think it would make a great show or a movie. You know, I think it would be, I think she deserves her time. She was such a big figure and she was such a huge figure, not just like she did all these crimes and people were very obsessed with her too. So I think that would make for a great show or movie or something like that.
I think a mini series, because I don't think a movie can encompass all of the nuance. I want to see a little bit of her childhood too, you know?
That's true.
I want to see those moments. I've decided I'm producing. Okay. without, you know, money, but that's fine.
Right.
I'll just keep talking. It'll be fine. Hey,
right? I mean, it's the Cassie Chadwick way, right?
Right.
Without any money, use other people's money. So what's next for you, Annie? Have you thought about your next book and like your next project or, you know?
I'm working on it now. It's kind of still in the keep it under wraps stage. It's another book another female U.S. criminal in history. So it's always going to be something along those lines. Yeah.
Excellent.
But I'll let you guys know once I can make it public.
Yeah.
Please do. And please come back on once it's been published, you know, because obviously we want to plug it like your book now. And listeners, please go and support this. It is a fun read. Like we said, it's nonfiction, but it doesn't read like, you know, because I think when people think of nonfiction, they think of, oh, boring, just facts. And
it's
but
not.
The way Annie has written this, it's very like it's just so engaging, and it reads very fast, but it's so enjoyable, and it's real. And you're like turning a page, and you're like, no way, they didn't fall for that. No. So they absolutely fell for it. So go and pick up The Imposter Heiress, Cassie Chadwick, The Greatest Grifter of the Gilded Age by Annie Reid. Annie, thank you so much for your time and for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. And we want you to sell lots and lots of books, and we want to get this movie/miniseries made with Amy Adams. I mean, I feel like this could be a bidding war. I feel like it could be, you know, I don't know. It could be Margot Robbie.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like she wouldn't mind wanting to do this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I think Reese Witherspoon would be all over this. Like,
oh,
right?
My gosh.
Listen.
There's so many.
We'll have them come in. And, you know, we'll talk to their agents and their managers. No problem.
Right.
I'm just going to keep talking.
Right.
Okay. I've learned a lot this hour.
It's done. It's just, and all we just want to get an invitation to the premiere.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yes. Of course.
And that's
Thank
all
you.
We want. And that's it. And then, of course, obviously, you'll come back on and grace us with your presence. But we are putting that positive energy out there for you guys, for you and your project. Again, guys, The Imposter Heiress, Cassie Chadwick, The Greatest Grifter of the Gilded Age. Thank you again, Annie, for joining us today. And we really, really appreciate you. If you just give us a moment, we're going to wrap up the show. And guys, you heard that. We're wrapping up the show. So remember,
That's right.
you know the thing. Remember to follow us on all the things. Also, it's a great Christmas gift. It's a great Christmas gift, New Year's gift. You know, go out and support the show. Download it. Where can they find the book, Annie? Actually, before we wrap it up, where can they find the book?
Pretty much anywhere where books are sold, Barnes & Noble and Amazon websites. I think it's in some Barnes & Noble stores, but not all. So go online, find it on one of those two sites.
Yes. And do you want to plug your socials?
Oh,
where can
yeah.
they find you, actually?
My website is www.authorannieread.com. I'm on Twitter at, I think it's _AnnieRead, author Annie Reid. Oh, boy. Well, I'm on Twitter and it's my name. So, and then on Facebook as well.
Great. Again, wrapping it up once again. Remember to follow us on all the things. Also, just copy the link of this episode and any episode of the Notorious Women podcast and send it to your friend. Copy the link and send it to them. And you can do that right after you do a 5-star review. Mm-hmm. Five stars. Just like Annie's book, 5 stars. Okay.
Five.
and you can do that on Spotify and in the Apple Store. And Miriam, how else can they and also Patreon. We have a Patreon. If you want to support the show financially, you can do that at patreon.com/notoriouswomen. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And Miriam, how else can they find us and support the show?
Y'all, we have social media. Okay, so we have Notorious Women Podcast on Instagram, Notorious Women Podcast on TikTok. They're different. I do different things. I run them. I'm going to take the credit. But they're fun. You should follow. We have like very, very few opinions. We're very quiet and meek in our... I'm just kidding. We're very loud.
Demure.
Demure. Yes. That's totally my... how people define me. Mm-hmm. What's so funny? Okay. And we're on Blue Sky too. So, you know, that's Notorious Women. And you can also listen to episodes on YouTube, Notorious Women Podcast. And that is that.
Yeah, that will wrap it up. Thank you again, Annie Reed, for joining us. And guys, we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.